is by no means confined to the bloody rampages of small-town white boys. Drive-by shootings committed by urban gangbangers, usually members of racial and ethnic minorities, proceed with regularity, never attracting the level of media attention and pontification elicited by the Johnsons, Goldens, and Kinkles of our time. A bit of covert racism, perhaps? We don't expect it of white kids? Nevertheless, something about the horror perpetuated by Mitchell Johnson and Andrew Golden seemed especially nauseating. To be so young and yet kill with such a finely honed sense of premeditation. To be so cold. I'd been trained as a child clinical psychologist, worked for 2 decades at a major urban hospital, and as a private practitioner, had witnessed plenty of psychopathology firsthand. But on March 26, 1998, my education and experience seemed pathetically inadequate. I struggled to make sense of the rampage. Was there anything I'd learned about human development that could come close to explaining calculated slaughter carried out by a fresh-faced pair who hadn't even nudged puberty? Mitchell Johnson and Drew Golden's bloody adventure kept me up all night. On Thursday morning, I was feeling pretty ragged and no more enlightened. I retired to my office, closed the door, turned off the phone, did a lot of thinking, reviewed dozens of books and scores of scholarly articles, meandered mentally through hundreds of case histories, and thought some more. Then I sat down, composed an essay, and sent it to Glenn Nishimura, op-ed editor at USA Today, where it was published the following morning. Late in the afternoon of the 26th, before I heard back from Nishimura, I received a phone call from my literary agent, Barney Karpfinger. Well aware of my reluctance to interrupt my fiction writing, he wondered, nonetheless, if I'd consider a nonfiction project. Peter Gethers, vice president and editor-at-large at Random House, had created a series entitled The Library of Contemporary Thought, a collection of short books issued monthly, authored by established writers on topics that resonated for them personally. My name had come up. Would I be willing to contribute a volume on childhood violence? Barney, I said, I've already started. Tim. This kid scared me. Call him Tim. I've forgotten his name, but Tim will do fine. He was 13, but could have passed easily for 16. Tall, angular, muscular, tan, with clean-cut good looks. He wore pressed, conservative clothing, uninfluenced by the trends of the day, possessed a ready smile, the gift of gab, and a stack of personalized business cards, one of which he handed me as he sat down across from my therapist chair. It was the late 70s, a smog-choked California summer early in the evening. I was working days at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, conducting research on the psychological effects of catastrophic illness and isolation upon children, setting up psychological support systems for kids with cancer and their families, and learning more about human misery and resilience than I'd ever imagined possible. Nights, I treated private patients, working out of a sublet office in a working-class San Fernando Valley neighborhood, a district of white faces, smallish stucco homes, stingy backyards, pampered pickups, loud motorcycles. Tim's parents had died in an auto accident when he was 18 months old, and he had been raised by his grandmother, a well-meaning but noticeably anxious woman in her 60s, who projected an air of profound ineptitude. She wasn't happy about seeing a psychologist. In the late 70s, few people outside of Beverly Hills and Upper Manhattan were, certainly not the tradesmen and housewives who comprised the bulk of the population in my district. Most of the parents referred to me never called. I didn't mind. It meant that the children who did arrive at my office were more likely to have real problems. After all, I was a medical school professor and had no desire to be a high-priced babysitter. Tim's pediatrician had convinced Grandma to bring Tim for evaluation, having exhausted all the advice at his disposal. He termed Grandma nice but antsy, hoped some of your behavior modification will help her. I asked him about any physical ailments Tim might have. He said Tim was one of the healthiest boys he'd ever encountered. On the face, Tim's presenting problem seemed no different from that of many boys I saw that summer or in summers past. Non-compliant behavior.